When the sun sets and the twilight settles, we're left with only darkness and whatever lurks within it. Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm your host, Maria Segura, and you're listening to Seattle Public Radio at 1 in the morning. Tonight, filling our 1 a.m. slot and playing for the first time on the air, the long-awaited Lovecraftian neo-noir show, Elder Sign. Starring Jasmine Jang as Hazel Blair and Anthony Mendoza as Jason Reed, featuring David Zybert as the narrator. Now, sit back, turn off the lights, and listen in as we delve into the darkness in the home.
The rain is heavy tonight, as I sit here writing in this thick leather-bound journal. My hands tremble as the lightning continues to crash outside my study window. This dark, rainy night, I sit alone with my wrinkled fingers struggling to hold the pen, but I push myself to write. My time is quickly approaching. I know this to be true, for I can feel death staring me down from the darkened corners of the room. Shadows slowly creeping toward me. Please understand that I do not write to you out of a hobbyist's enthusiasm. I write to you because I feel that I must. I write to you because I feel you need to be warned, to be prepared for the trials ahead, for there will be many. Enclosed in my last will and testament were the instructions to the bequeathing of my personal effects, objects I found of material value to my close friends and family. These include my estate here in Philadelphia, my extensive library, and my fortune that has been passed down from my grandfather to me. Now that I have left the corporeal world, I pass it all on to you, including, of course, my most prized possession, the journal that is now before you. I hope that the process of obtaining this journal was not too strenuous, and though I am no longer with you, know that you have my best hopes and wishes, as does the rest of humanity, present and future. I feel that now that my time on this earth nears completion, you must know the knowledge I once learned in years long forgotten. I know you may think yourself too old to hear tales and stories, but please humor an old writer's mind. My writings are the story of a woman who I look upon as someone even I in my age admire. Her name was Hazel Blair, and I remember her tales like I heard them yesterday. I implore you to remember distant memories from long ago, to remember a time when you lived in Seattle, the city of goodwill, the city by the sea with its mist, its gloom, but also its superb culture and art. Back then you were a teenager, but I know strangely that you can't remember much of our time there. There in Seattle's bustling midtown was where Hazel once lived and also worked. In the days of the past, Hazel was a beautiful woman. Blonde, wavy hair that descended down her back. Large, pine-green eyes that accompanied her round, pouty face. Her nose, small, yet pointed. Hazel's lips were never glossed or colored by lipstick, as she had the rosiest red lips I could remember. If I think more carefully, I remember her being about 5'5", for I could look down on her, but not so much as to strain one's neck. Hazel, in her youth, was both talented and inquisitive, quickly achieving the position of detective of the Seattle Police Department at the age of 25. However, our story doesn't take start with her as detective. No, our story starts with Hazel one rainy night, much like the night I write during. The story began a few years later, in a time where she no longer worked for the police of King County, in a time where darkness and depression were slowly gaining on her, despite her best efforts. I remember Hazel telling me of that night. She couldn't forget it. And how could she? For that night changed the course of her entire life to come. The rain came down quite excessively that darkened evening in Seattle, according to her. The headlights of her car illuminated the rain-soaked concrete. Hazel drove in silence, the only sound keeping her company being the heavy raindrops that pelted at her windshield. For the last few years, Hazel had been a licensed private investigator, doing jobs that required little effort on behalf of her sharpened and honed investigative mind. She told me that she rarely took jobs that called her in the middle of the night, but she did with this one. Hazel couldn't pass up the opportunity to work with the police department once more, even as an independent asset. That night she wore a gray pantsuit, tight and slimming, a pale red top beneath the gray jacket, and black heels strapped around her feet. Hazel's hands turned the steering wheel of her car slowly, rounding the corner into a nice suburban neighborhood. It was then that she saw the familiar police vehicles parked all along the street. Officers she once worked with side by side, standing behind yellow tape that surrounded the yard of one of the homes. The tires sprayed water from the deep puddles of the street as Hazel drove her car to the side of the road, a soft sigh leaving her as the car slowed to a stop. Hazel, with an apathetic and tired expression, took a look out of the car window at the homes along the road, rain spilling down over the glass. This was a nicer part of Seattle. Nicer than where Hazel lived, at least. The neighborhood consisted of larger homes, each with sprawling front lawns and three floors at the minimum. The house in question had the usual front yard with a concrete walkway that cut straight through. The walkway led up from the street to the front door. Police tape crossed over the wood. There were at least a dozen policemen simply standing out on the lawn, arms folded behind their backs, minding over the neighbors that stood watching beyond the tape. Hazel sighed, taking her hands to her long blonde hair, using a hair tie to make a simple ponytail. Heavy round raindrops pelted her hair and face as she stepped out of the car. She took a long look up at the dark, starless sky above, rain splashing across her face.
Jesus.
She stepped from the street onto the grass without so much as a newspaper or umbrella to block her from the rain. She approached an officer who was standing there, keeping watch over the neighbors, making sure that they didn't pass over the tape.
Excuse me? My name is Hazel Blair. The chief of police called me over. I was told Jason Reed was here. He's a detective with your department. Do you know where he is? I just don't see him outside. Oh, is that him by the patio?
Yeah, that's him.
Thank you.
Of course. No problem.
Hazel waved a hand in thanks to the officer before rushing out of the rain toward the patio. Jason that night wore tan khakis with a white dress shirt, the sleeves of which were hidden by his large black trench coat. He adorned a striped blue tie, and his hands held a notepad and pen. Though the stout man stood on the concrete patio in the cold, Jason had a smile on his face, his brown eyes darting from side to side of the notepad. Hearing the steps behind him, Jason turned to see the soft, smiling face of Hazel Blair.
Hazel, it's good to see you. God, I haven't seen you in forever. How are you doing? You look great, honestly.
It's good to see you too, Jason.
You got down here pretty quick. I was only called here about 40 minutes ago. And what a night to be called, right?
Yeah, the rain's coming down pretty hard, but even in this weather, I'm not going to just pass up the opportunity to work a case. Especially when the chief called and said he wanted me to work it personally.
Business as a PI is pretty slow for you, then.
No, I wouldn't say slow. It's just uninteresting. All I really do are those follow-my-cheating-wife type jobs. Pretty menial work, if you ask me, but it pays my bills. For now.
You know, the department would take you back in a heartbeat. You just need to do your psych evaluation and pass your...
Jason, we're waiting on you. Hurry it up.
All right, we'll be right in, sir. Sounds like they want us in the kitchen. Look, Hazel, I just think that it's been long enough since, you know, just think about coming back to the department, all right? I know that Chief Daniels gave you the option of coming back a while ago, and I think you were wrong to pass it up.
Jason, it's fine. I enjoy what I'm doing now. Being privatized suits me better than having the rules restricting me. I'm my own boss now, and I like that. Besides, some people wouldn't like me showing back up out of the blue.
Davis, I know. But Hazel, you know that he was just jealous you got detective before him. You shouldn't take him too personally. We've all changed in the past 2 years, especially Davis.
Yeah, I heard about his promotion.
He's a sergeant now, so I'm sure he'll understand the chief calling you. And remember, some people do want to see you back with the department. So who cares what Davis thinks? Come on, everyone's waiting.
Jason stepped off the porch and into the foyer, with Hazel following close behind, taking a quick glance at the house's interior. The foyer itself was massive. A huge marble floor with a black circular design contrasting the polished white marble. To the left was an entry to what looked like a dining room, a grand oak table already set for dinner.
Come on, they're in here.
He made a brisk right, heading into the kitchen. The mansion's kitchen was covered floor to ceiling in spotless white tiles. Detectives wearing suits were waiting inside the room, standing huddled around a large black splotch on the tiled floor, a frying pan lying nearby. Standing near the stove, arms folded across his chest, was Davis.
Thank you, Jason, for finally deciding to join us.
Davis Long stood in the center of the kitchen, his eyes glaring at both Jason and Hazel. He towered over most in the room, with a height of 6'3", his smooth, bald head standing out amongst the crowd. His steely blue eyes stared down Hazel as she entered the room, his brow furrowed in a mix of frustration and anger. His back straightened as Jason approached, uncrossing his arms and shoving his hands deep into his pockets. His gray trench coat pulled back as he straightened up, revealing his badge and Glock strapped to his belt. Behind the thick leather coat was a neatly pressed suit. Muscles pressed and bulged against the suit, presenting him as not only a figure of authority, but also a figure of intimidation.
Yeah, sorry about taking so long, Davis. Just trying to catch up with our friend Hazel.
Yes, I can see that. I guess that it was Chief Daniels that called you in for this?
Yes, he called saying that he wanted every available hand on this. But from what he said, I thought this was nothing but a simple breaking and entering.
Well, with who the victim is, I guess I should have assumed he would have called you. And the chief may be right, this is pretty much an open and shut case. Unfortunately, it's our victim who claims it's not so simple. So, let's go over it one more time, everyone, for Hazel's sake. Pay attention! I refuse to go over this again, so shut up and listen. Thank you. As we can see, Veronica Blethyn was making dinner for herself here in front of the stove around 12 a.m.
Excuse me. Veronica Blethyn, as in the founding name and president family of the Seattle Times?
Hazel, I wish I could say it's good to see you again. If I remember correctly, you made detective even before me, isn't that right?
Yes, sir, that is correct.
I know, everyone. It's a surprise that happened. And if I'm still remembering correctly, and pardon me if I'm incorrect, but you attacked me after the death of your friend, Stephen, I think that was his name. You had a mental breakdown in the chief's office, didn't you?
The other detectives looked down at the ground, some snickering at the disgraced former detective, others glad it was her taking Davis's brash criticism rather than they.
Sir, it was more of a nervous breakdown.
Guys, come on, stop it.
Yes, a nervous breakdown. One that you claim was caused by attending the scene of the accident where your friend was pulled dead from a car wrapped around a tree. I'm sorry that that was so traumatic, but let's not forget how you attacked me in the chief's office days after your friend's death. So pardon me if I'm a little troubled by your presence here, just remember, I'm in charge here. This is my case. I can decide whether I want you or not. So do us all a favor, your friend Jason included, and keep your mouth shut. I'd like to do this without having to answer all your stupid questions. That understood?
Yes. Sorry.
Good. All right, take a good look at Miss Blair, everyone. What you see is a person that lacks respect, determination, and drive. Someone lacking those three things will eventually end up a failure like she did. Hazel Blair was and is a person driven by anger, fear, and obsession. All things that can get you in trouble, or worse, with a job as intense as this. It doesn't matter if you were considered one of the best investigative minds the West Coast ever saw. You show up with complete disrespect of authority, you end up making a fool of yourself. She is, without doubt, the prime example of what happens when you let this job get to you. You spiral out of control, and before you know it, you go from 25 and a detective with one of the best departments in the country to almost 30, and now a meek little private investigator, taking pictures of sweaty nude husbands in motels and chasing down leads for biological parents to make a few bucks. You want to end up a nobody lunatic the chief pities? Hazel's your gal. Okay, I think everyone, including Miss Blair, has learned a valuable lesson. So let's get back to the scene. It looks like Mrs. Blethyn was cooking dinner when she heard someone break in through the living room. She stopped what she was doing when she heard the shatter of the window and moved to the center of the room, here. At this point, Mrs. Blethyn heard footsteps come from the dining room. What she saw was most definitely the criminal, though she doesn't seem to agree with this. Now, for all those hoping to move up from beat to robbery, special ops, or even homicide, here is a great case of what happens when hysteria takes control of a situation. While we know it was a man that entered the home, possibly with the intent to loot the place, Mrs. Blethyn describes the figure as a bubbling black mass sliding through the darkness with multiple gibbering mouths and round inhuman eyes. This is a perfect example of situational hysteria. The imagination can certainly go berserk when a person panics, which seems to be the case here. The darkness in the home, added with the fact an unknown intruder broke in, probably exaggerated everything. Now, we can look at the scene and simply assume that she panicked when she saw the intruder. Looks like she dropped the pan of oil on the floor, which caused a small grease fire, making that black spot right over there. Now, it's at this point that the burglar bolted, either because of the fire or just the fact that someone also in the home startled him. We've talked with most of the neighbors, all of whom say Mrs. Blethyn was acting normally. We got reports of her jogging, planting in her garden, speaking with neighbors with the afternoon ending. Blethyn drove uptown. She's a night owl, so making dinner this late's probably not unusual for her. Now, from what I've heard or seen, no one saw anybody suspicious moving around the neighborhood in the past few days or this evening. Nobody saw this criminal run off, either. So he could be poking around nearby, but I doubt it.
So you don't think it's anything, sir?
Nah, I don't see this as anything more than a failed breaking and entering. Guy probably saw the nice house thinking he'd make some quick cash, nothing more, nothing less. For peace of mind, I'll have officers patrol the neighborhood one more time, and have a squad car parked here on the street for maybe a couple more hours. Other than that, there's nothing more to do. All right. We're done here, everyone. Let's pack it up, head back to the station. I want full reports on my desk by tomorrow morning. Understand? Get moving.
Mutters began sprouting amongst the small crowd of officers and detectives in the kitchen as they prepared to leave. Hazel looked at her once fellow officers, watching them leave as they snickered and whispered about her. Paying her so-called friends no mind, she then turned to Davis, who was going back through his notes.
Wait, then why were so many officers called out here?
It's not going to be released in the press, but apparently Mrs. Blethyn ran out of the house screaming about some monster. Neighbors tried to help her out, but Mrs. Blethyn bit off someone's finger.
Jesus!
Yes, Mrs. Blethyn did become violent, and when officers arrived, they subdued her. No idea what made her go apeshit like that, but it's not my job to find out. Hopefully, she'll be more responsive and pleasant when we interview her tomorrow for the final report. Reed, if we're done here, I'm going to head outside and have a word with the others. I expect to see you back at the station with all the witness reports. You understand?
Yes, Sergeant. I'll meet you back at the station.
Good. I'll see you there.
Well, I guess it was nothing after all. Sorry that the chief had you drive all this way for nothing. If you want, we can go out for a drink or a bite to eat.
Thanks for the offer, Jason, but no, I'm all right. And don't worry about this being a waste of time. I needed to get out of the apartment anyway. A little fresh air did me some good. But, hey, would you mind if I checked out the other rooms? Like the living room? I just want to go back over everything, and I think seeing it for myself will confirm everything I need.
Yeah. I don't see why not. Just don't take too long, okay? I don't need Davis breathing down my neck about letting you poke around his crime scene. I'll be outside gathering up the witness reports. Come see me afterwards, all right?
Yeah, no, of course. I'll see you outside.
Remember, don't take too long.
Now completely alone, Hazel could see how they'd think that Mrs. Blethyn was simply just paranoid. Silence seemed to make the darkness more ominous. While it was an uncomfortable feeling, being alone in someone else's home, Hazel took a deep breath of confidence and continued her walk deeper into the lonely mansion. Hazel sauntered through the foyer, her heels echoing with each step as she approached the dining room. Passing through, Hazel saw an archway that connected to a new area. She now looked upon the living room. It too was beautifully decorated. Leather sitting chairs were placed with a circular end table between them. In the left corner was a gentleman's bar. A bright red Turkish rug encompassed the floor, and shelves full of hard-covered books lined the walls. A sense of classical elegance stopping her beneath the archway. Once finished taking in the room's decor, she stepped onto the vibrant rug. Suddenly, the sound of a creaking board broke the maddening silence that surrounded her. The sound was so fortuitous and sudden that Hazel gasped, taking a hand and placing it to her beating chest. The silence was no longer troubling. Instead, it was soothing, if not for a time, for it meant no one was here but her. No one she could see, at least. Regaining her bearings, Hazel searched around the classically designed interior to find where the intruder had entered. After looking behind the large drapes, Hazel found that the lower window pane that overlooked the backyard was broken. It appeared as if someone had used his or her fist to punch a hole in the glass. But something interesting about the window caught Hazel's eye.
What's this? A locked window latch? Why would the guy lock the window on his way out?
This, however, was diminutive, almost infinitesimal, in comparison to what she saw outside of said window.
What the fuck is that?
Outside the window, the grass of the backyard was compressed into an unnaturally perfect circle. Her mind tried to comprehend what sort of massive being left such a maddeningly flawless imprint. Hazel saw the footprints of someone, most likely the culprit, advancing toward the home. The footprints stopped at the edge of the disquieting circle. Strange and out of place. A hand suddenly grasped Hazel's shoulder, and a scream of surprise escaped her.
Whoa, sorry. I didn't mean to sneak up on you, Hazel.
Jesus Christ, Jason. It's fine. Just, fuck, give me a warning next time.
Well, I'm sorry. Are you finished? Davis wants to wrap this up, and frankly, so do I. I'm starving.
Yeah, I'm ready. But Jason, did you guys look at the latch on the window? Why would the guy lock the window on his way out after breaking in? Doesn't that seem pointless to you?
Yeah, we saw that, but it doesn't really matter, Hazel. I mean, it doesn't forward the case. Maybe Blethyn locked it herself when the guy left.
But you said that Mrs. Blethyn was hysterical. Hysterical enough to bite someone's finger off. I don't think she was too concerned with locking the window after he ran. And what about that weird patch of flattened grass outside?
We saw that too, but it obviously doesn't pertain to the case, because the guy couldn't have made it, period.
I mean, it's possible he fell on his way out the window, but a fall wouldn't make anything like that. It's huge, 20 feet in diameter at least.
Look, I agree, it's really weird, but we have to go. Davis and a few of the other detectives are outside, upset that the chief would bring you in on this. I'm sorry, but I don't want to get on his bad side by holding this up any further.
I thought it didn't matter what Davis or the others thought about me.
Hazel, you know
it's fine. We'll go, I promise. But I'd like to ask something.
Hazel?
I'd just like to talk to the lady. Something weird is going on, I can tell. There's more to this than a basic robbery, and I think she's our best bet at figuring it all out.
Mrs. Blevin? Hazel, listen, okay? She's hysterical right now. She's lucky that her neighbors aren't pressing charges after the finger thing. Besides, Davis and I aren't even going to talk to her until tomorrow morning. Just leave it be, okay? If she does have something to say, Davis and I'll figure it out then. You know, you always did this when you were on the force, and 9 times out of 10, it was you just digging deeper into something that wasn't there.
Jason, there's something going on. And you know that if Davis has his way, I won't be part of the investigation.
Hazel, it's just a simple B&E case. Nothing more, okay? And you do know that there are ways to be involved in these kinds of cases on a full-time basis if you came back to the department.
I'm not coming back. I don't want anything to do with the police force, all right?
The chief already said he would pay for everything. The psych evaluation, firearm recertification, every—
Jason! No, okay? After I pulled Steven out of that car, I just can't. Especially if when I show back up, I have everyone staring and laughing at me like I'm some kind of freak.
You're not a freak. You just had some
Look, if you were my friend, you'd understand that I couldn't come back. Not now, at least. And if you respected me professionally, you'd understand that my instincts are strong on this one. There is something going on here, Jason. This case isn't that simple. I know it's not. Please. You just have to trust me.
God damn it, Hazel. She's at Northwest Hospital over on 115th. She's being evaluated by the psych department for trauma or something. I don't know. I didn't really ask when she was being carted away. I was too busy dealing with the fallout over the finger incident.
Jason, thank you. You have no idea what this means to me. I'll get over there tonight, get it over with, and go home. And please make sure that Davis doesn't hear about this, okay?
Just get over to the hospital and get it done, and keep me in the loop, please. You call me as soon as you get what you think you need, and then let me and Davis handle it from there. I need you to please, for the love of God, please follow the chain of command here.
I promise that I will, don't worry.
No. Don't promise me, just do it, alright? Call me as soon as something happens so Davis and I can act on it. You're working for the police, so you need to keep us all, Davis included, in the loop.
Jason, I'll call you, okay? Please just stop freaking out. What, do you not trust me or something?
Oh, I trust you, Hazel, I really do. I'm going to be uptown, most likely at a Chinese place. I need to grab a bite to eat after the paperwork at the station. I'll be up, so call me, even if it's 5 in the morning, all right?
I already promised I would call you, Jason. What more do you want?
You just haven't ever really had the greatest track record with following orders. I just want to make sure we do this right.
Jason, calm down. I will. Stop worrying. I'll see you later in the morning.
Hazel stepped out into the pouring Seattle rain. She walked down the concrete path to the street, where she'd parked her car earlier. She climbed in the car inside as she placed her keys in the ignition.
Better than doing nothing at home. Again.
Jason's incessant persistence for her to join the police again, accompanied with the wet roads of Seattle, brought back the memory of Stephen's red coupe, its hood and bumper wrapped unevenly around the tree. Lightning illuminated the interior as Hazel and firefighters looked inside the totaled car. She remembered Stephen's body, mangled and covered in crimson blood that pooled and slid across every surface. Splatter from his skull smeared on the inside window. The rain diluted the human juices as they dripped from the ceiling and window onto the floor. She remembered seeing his bones bulging out beneath his shirt and pants, jaggedly protruding through skin and muscle. Stephen's mangled face was still fresh in her mind, his void crimson eyes bleeding profusely from the head trauma caused by the crash, his jaw jutting to the side, his teeth bent back into their gums, his tongue swinging like a pendulum with every slight movement of his fragmented and fractured body dangled down from his gaping maw. All the memories she had of him now were of his gruesome, lifeless vessel.
Oh, shit! The turn!
Quickly, Hazel made a sharp right, pulling into Northwest Hospital.
I must be exhausted. I can't let myself get sucked into thinking about Steven again, especially on a night like this.
She drove into and through the hospital's garage, parking up on the 3rd floor. Removing the key from the ignition, she reached out for her purse that was placed on the passenger seat. Her arm was extended as her hands rummaged through the contents, feeling for her phone, which lurked beneath. Hazel lit up as she grabbed something, pulling it out of the bag. Pepper spray.
It's a hospital. I won't need this in a fucking hospital.
Hazel placed the metallic canister in her car's cup holder, reaching back to sift through the purse once more. After several grueling moments, she successfully pulled out her phone, turning it on to see the time. 2:37 a.m. She walked, hoping that her trip wasn't pointless. Hoping, in truth, that her hunch about all this was right. She walked through the halls of the almost vacant hospital, looking around for anyone that could direct her until she found a nurse's station. There sat a single nurse typing away on an older computer. Asking the nurse for Veronica Blevin, the nurse pulled up the patient name and room number, room 541. With that, Hazel nodded and smiled kindly to the nurse, who pointed her in the direction of the elevators. As she walked down the hall, Hazel heard rapid footsteps approaching from behind, and when she turned to look, saw a man quickly approaching. The man wore a blue button-up shirt, the bottom loosely hanging down over his blue jeans. He was slender, his pants baggy around his skinny legs. His face was gaunt, cheeks pale and slightly sunken, yet healthy. His black eyebrows curved perfectly to give him a sort of regal look. The man's lengthy jet black hair bobbed as he walked along beside Hazel, his blue eyes darting around the hall looking for something or someone.
Excuse me, pardon me, miss. I overheard you talking with that nurse about Veronica Blevin. Is that right?
Yeah. Why do you ask? Do I know you?
I'm her son. My name's Timothy Blevin. I live in Portland, but I drove up here as soon as I heard about her being admitted. It's nice to meet you.
I didn't know she had any children. I thought she only had a husband, and he died a decade ago.
She and I weren't on the best of terms when my father died. I wanted to run the paper, but she said it wasn't going to happen. So I left for Portland. But after I heard about her episode...
Her biting and ripping off someone's finger?
Yeah, that. After I heard, I took to the highway and tried to get her as soon as possible. You're investigating the break-in?
Well, you could say that.
I was actually hoping to talk with someone working the case about what happened.
Oh, here are the elevators. Look, I'm not a police officer, okay? So I don't think I'm the one to talk about the case.
I thought you were investigating her and the break-in.
Oh, thank God. And to answer you, I'm investigating, yeah, but I'm not a cop.
Hazel gave a quick flash of a forced smile to Timothy before stepping completely into the elevator.
Oh, please don't.
Unfortunately for Hazel, Timothy hastily stepped into the elevator with her. With great effort, Hazel did her best to suppress the groan she could feel forming in her throat.
So you're like a private investigator, then?
Oh my God. No, I'm not like a private investigator. I am a private investigator.
Oh, sorry.
Luckily for Hazel, Timothy had stopped his incessant questions and idiotic speech before they entered onto the fifth floor. To Hazel, this was a godsend, as it meant she could focus fully on finding Mrs. Blevin rather than deal with her blathering son. When the doors slid open, revealing the hallway, Hazel and Timothy both stepped out of the elevator, Hazel keeping a brisk and steady pace towards room 541. She didn't look behind her to see if Timothy was there because she could hear him, keeping stride with her, his every step only 2 feet behind her own. In our time together, Hazel and I, she told me once that she hated strangers. Better yet, she hated people in general. When she told me this story, she made it clear to me that she had distaste for the man from the beginning. As annoying as he was, Timothy did, however, pose a sort of momentous significance to the case. The son of Mrs. Blevin would, or at least should, know more about her mental state and possibly calm her enough to make sense of the crime. After almost 20 minutes of searching the hospital halls, they had found it. Room 541. The room's large wooden door contained a rectangular window used to view inside the room from the hall. With a slight smile at her small victory, Hazel proceeded to look through the window due to nagging curiosity. Inside was a doctor with long, dark brown hair wearing the typical lab coat and blue scrubs. Her features were sharp, almost menacingly so. Her eyebrows were curved in such a way that one would assume she was angry. The doctor's chestnut brown eyes were large and fierce, and when her head turned, those piercing eyes looked directly into Hazel's, who felt her stomach twist. The doctor was standing next to a bed where an elderly woman, Mrs. Blethyn, was lying awake but unresponsive. An IV was stuck in her arm. Wires were arranged on Mrs. Blethyn's chest, each connected to machines that read her blood pressure and heart rate. Her wrists were attached to the sides of the medical bed by means of padded restraints. Her face was partially blocked by messy white and gray hair that slunk down and clung to her barely rising chest. Wrinkles on her face and hands showed just how truly ancient she was. Though unresponsive to the doctor standing above her, Mrs. Blethyn's eyes darted as her head twitched and jolted in an unusually bizarre fashion, as if she were watching something that quickly crawled back and forth across the ceiling. In Hazel's focus of Mrs. Blethyn, she didn't notice that the doctor had left the side of the bed and was now approaching the door, a clipboard tucked tightly underneath her left arm. Hazel took a step back from the door when the doctor reached out for the handle.
Hello. My name is Dr. Alice Kalishnikov. I'm one of the attending doctors for the psych department. May I ask why you're staring at my patient?
I'm Hazel Blair. I'm working with the police department to determine what exactly happened earlier this evening. I'd like to speak with Mrs. Blethyn, get a handle on what happened at her house.
Well, unfortunately for you, Miss Blair, my patient is currently not ready to talk about what happened. The trauma is too severe.
Wait, what about me? I need to...
Excuse me. Are you a doctor?
Well, no, but...
Are you a police officer or working with the police in any way?
No, but...
Well then, sir, I'll remind you that it's 3 in the morning, and visiting hours are long over. If what you have to ask is really that important, then you can wait for me at my office, room 214. As of now, our conversation ends here.
The doctor's eyes were unblinking as she proceeded to inform the now emasculated man of his situation. Timothy's face went blank, and he simply, stupidly stood there. He slowly looked over to Hazel, who simply turned her head to look back at him with her own expression of consternation. Timothy nodded sheepishly and began his walk back from whence he'd come, heading for the elevators to take to the second floor. Hazel turned her focus back onto the doctor, who was once again staring at her, coldly. Hazel flashed a quick smile, but the doctor did not act amused.
So, what exactly have you gotten from Mrs. Blethyn?
Mainly ramblings. Something about her husband and her basement, followed with gibberish. She's in a terrible state of shock after the incident. I'm surprised no one brought her in here sooner. With that kind of shock, her dementia probably exaggerated the experience.
What do you mean by that?
Well, your victim, Mrs. Blethyn, is showing signs of fifth stage or CDR3 leveled dementia. In my professional opinion, she's senile and extremely impaired.
What? No, that's impossible. She can't be senile.
She's of the age when a disease like Alzheimer's fully sets in. It's not at all unusual. Her husband also died a while ago, so the lengthy periods of loneliness probably accelerated the disease.
No, it's unusual and impossible because dementia takes years to set in fully. She was fine just this afternoon, according to her neighbors. I can call Jason Reed at the Seattle Police Department to fax the witness reports over right now to prove that.
Are you suggesting that my diagnosis is incorrect, ma'am?
I'm saying that it could be possible. Yes, due to what the police found at the crime scene and what witnesses there were, I'm saying that you could be exaggerating it a bit.
All right then, Miss Blair. Why don't you tell me what you think?
Hazel gave an astounded look at the doctor, who was simply standing there forcing a pleasant smile. Hazel nodded, however, and took a step forward past the doctor and into the room. Another step, and Hazel was no longer in the hall, but now completely in the room, with the doctor closing the door slowly behind her. She took a deep breath before stepping forward towards the medical bed, a makeshift prison for a feeble woman. The journey to Mrs. Blethyn's side seemed like an eternity to Hazel. The sounds of her own breath filling her head, the beating of her heart heard in her ears only getting louder with each step taken. Even the babbling, which seemed to go on incessantly, was smothered by the sound of her own heart pounding. Hazel's breaths were raspy and quick, a feeling of suffocation absorbing her as a primal fear took over. Hazel was finally at the edge of the bed, looking down at Mrs. Bledin. Hazel opened her mouth. No sound coming out at first, but she finally forced out a very soft greeting.
Hello, Veronica. My name is...
Hazel Blair.
Mrs. Bledin had suddenly stopped her twitching and babbling, her eyes no longer moving inside her head, but now staring at the white ceiling. Hazel stood there, her mouth slightly agape and her eyes moving around the room quickly, due to fear and shock.
How did you know my name? Did the police tell you?
Mrs. Bledin's ramblings had stopped, which, in Hazel's frightened mind, was a favorable start. However, Mrs. Bledin's empty stare at the ceiling above was more than unsettling to Hazel. She did nothing but lay there, and Hazel could only look upon her in silence. Finally, with a deep breath, Hazel moved down closer to Mrs. Bledin.
Ma'am?
Hazel asked, softly, with a slight tilt of her head, attempting to suppress the growing fear she felt. Suddenly, Mrs. Bledin's right hand flew up and clasped around Hazel's wrist. With unusual strength, the elderly woman pulled Hazel close to her, large, gaping eyes staring into Hazel's.
The basement. It was always the basement.
What's in the basement?
I won't go back. I won't do it. It's waiting for me. It was hideous. The eyes, oh God, the eyes. Bubbling, pulsing black skin as it slid through the darkness. The eyes.
Mrs. Bledin then began to scream in dementia-ridden fear.
The eyes.
Her arms and legs flailing about as far as the restraints would let her. Hazel pulled away from the elderly woman's tight grasp on her lower arm, taking a step back. She watched the elderly woman kick and writhe her body on the bed like a grotesque worm. Hazel quickly retreated backwards towards the door, not taking her eyes off the clearly sick woman. She outstretched her arms behind her, her hands pawing for the door. After several large strides back, Hazel's hand felt the door press against the tips of her fingers. She turned quickly around, reaching for the handle, but something stopped her. A sound. A most hideous sound. The screaming and sobbing had stopped, but now it was replaced with an eerily calm laugh. A laugh that came from Mrs. Bledin.
Hazel, be a dear. When you find it, burn it. Those eyes will be looking for you next.
After a moment of silence, Mrs. Bledin erupted into a huge cacophony of laughter behind Hazel, sick, twisted cackles that echoed within the room. Hazel turned the handle and entered back into the hall. She found Dr. Kalashnikov standing with her arms crossed.
Well?
You should tell her son just how sick she is. He'll want to know.
Her son?
The man that was with me, he was her son. He wanted to know how she was doing, that's why he was here with me.
Miss Blair, Ms. Bledin doesn't have a son. She has two daughters.
Elder Sign was created and produced by Thomas McKean. It was written by Thomas McKean, Toby Riggs, and Lalandra Chrisman Stratton. It is copyrighted under a Creative Commons license with not all rights owned exclusively. The voice of the narrator was David Zybert. The voice of Hazel Blair was Jasmine Jang. The voice of Jason Reed was Anthony Mendoza. The voice of Davis Long was Kirk Gardner. The voice of Dr. Kalashnikov was Darcy Leonardson. The voice of Veronica Bledin was Kathy Welch. The voice of Timothy Bledin was Robert Simpson. Music was provided and approved by Peter Helland, Cryo Chamber Dark Ambiance, and Bong Ra. You can find the music of Peter Helland at his website at peterbhelland.com, or just check the link in the show notes. The many musics of Cryo Chamber can be found at their site, cryochamberlabel.com. Bong Ra's music, including songs performed by the Kilimanjaro Dark Jazz Ensemble and the Fuji Doom Jazz Corporation, can be found at their site,
listed in the show notes. Bongra's current project, The Thing with Five Eyes, can be found at the project's Bandcamp, thethingwithfiveeyes.bandcamp.com.